I'm Matthew.
I'm Marty.
I'm Carlos.
And we are the Heroes 3. Welcome to Heroes 3, the bi-weekly podcast where three friends explore the best, worst, and everything in between in the world of Asian cinema. And this week we are finishing up our look at Thai cinema with 2005's Tom Yong Gung, which is also directed by Prachet Pin Keo and is starring Tony Jaa, as we've had the other ones, and with, of course, this is kind of just a Panarittig Krai arc at this point.
Yeah, I suppose
But so. Action direction by Prachet Panarittig Krai.
Yeah, and also known in the U.S. and some other markets as The Protector.
Yes, yeah, this is, it's funny, look, the Wikipedia has like five different names in different markets, yeah. But yeah, I think I had heard of it as The Protector, but yes, this is, which is confusing because there's a couple of action movies that are also called The Protector, but
yeah,
whatever.
This 2005 Jackie Chan film, and then I think in the UK, I think it's known as Warrior King.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, lot, like you're saying, Matthew, lots of different handles for this thing.
But yeah, it's a really fun one. So yeah, yeah, Carlos, what's the? I think I know why you brought this to us, but yeah, why'd you bring this one to us?
Yeah, we did Chocolate, and we moved a little forward. With that was in 08, if I remember right.
And yes.
I wanted to finish off our first look at these major action films from Thailand with Tom Yong Gung. This is from 2005. Definitely my favorite of this handful of picks. And I really get a lot of enjoyment out of this film. And this is another case of dude, have you seen this film? Because when I originally saw this with my friends back in the day, we were just clamoring for another major Tony Jaa action film, and this is the one. This is what we got. It's a bit of a, I guess, in a thematic way, kind of a retake of the ideas from Ong Bak, but set on a higher stage and with a bigger budget and a more worldly view. But I'd also say it still is trying to portray Thailand as a culture to the world in a very successful but different way.
Yeah, no, that's really well put.
This dives into a side of Thailand that I was a little familiar with, but is cool to see on film, and that's elephants.
Yeah.
Elephants are a huge part of this movie, and it's super cool. It's a part of, kind of a part of Thai culture is elephants and the preservation of it, and get to have, we've had so many movies where the villain is like, you know, vague drug trade or, you know, sex trafficking, you know, other bad stuff. But we haven't had poaching yet, so good to see some poachers get got.
Dude, yeah, good point. Yeah, in many ways, we're kind of like swapping out the, you know, religious token MacGuffin from Ong Bak for a living, breathing, real life on camera elephant. And yeah, I'm totally with you. I mean, I think that definitely sharpens kind of the sense of villainy. I mean, because, yeah, it's like, what feeling person with a soul doesn't love elephants? I don't know. There's something just like so immediate about it. But it's interesting. Like, I hadn't watched The Protector for several years. And I was getting a whole different kind of perspective on it, just like watching it for this arc. And I think somewhat hot on the heels from Ong Bak. My memory of the time was like getting extremely activated by Ong Bak, and it felt like the wait for The Protector or Tom Yong Gung was like not that long, and was just like wowed by the scale of the choreography and the fights and the production value. I still think that this is like to date probably some of the best shot like action choreography and sequences like we've ever had as like a human race.
Whoa.
But I've got to say, it was making me appreciate Ong Bak as a film a lot more, and I was really kind of struggling to hang on to the movie of it in a way that I was really, kind of threw me for a loop.
I think I would agree. I do think Ong Bak works better as like a movie and like as a story that goes from one thing to the other, but I think the action set pieces in this movie are incredible, but you know, you can't, I don't think you can have a truly great action movie that's just cool action set pieces. Like, you got to have something to hold them together, at least for me. But I did like this movie, and I'm very glad to have that we watched it.
Yeah. And yeah, it's totally an essential watch. And honestly, like, I mean, I think even these many years later, there's something that just feels absolutely brand new about this action. Like, I don't know. It's, oh, dude, I was just about to say the elephant in the room, and the most appropriate that will ever be in our lives. But yeah, I think an elephant in the room, or something that's going to like hang over the whole podcast, is this legendary stretch of the movie that even if you don't think you know this movie, you do know this movie, mm-hmm. because there's like an internet breaking, I believe Guinness World Record in some way breaking, Steadicam sequence that is kind of a legend unto itself. But something I was really appreciating getting into the movie is that there's like an amazing Steadicam approach kind of to the fights from beginning to end. And I don't know, something about this like super tight, smooth Steadicam with like the wide angle lens and just the incredible caliber of physicality and the choreography. It's, dude, yeah, I mean, this thing just looks amazing to watch. And I don't know, it's this perfect kind of moment in time where the quality of the film stock is so good. Just kind of, there's something about like the edginess of, I don't know, the international 20-aughts or whatever that still feels like really fiery. And yeah, I don't know, can't get enough of just like how this action looks and is delivered. And like, these are the kind of stunts where like you've seen them 10 times and it's still just as like jaw-dropping. I don't know
the ideas that were presented with in this film. I mean we love Jackie, obviously, and definitely seeing some type of worldly kind of inspiration with what we're seeing in this
movie. I was thinking
of
Mr. Nice Guy a lot whenever I was watching through this.
Oh, yeah, that's a good reference. Yeah.
For me, I definitely think of things like that, but I was really thinking about, like, in the 80s, how we'd see Jackie and Sammo and Yimbyu kind of break out of just the Hong Kong, like, lens and kind of want to spread out
like
towards
international
players, like a Wheels on Meals situation. Or I also kind of get like Rumble in the Bronx vibes from film too. And I thought it's really cool to see a totally different worldview, kind of, I guess, wanting to break out into the worldview in a way from a different stunt team, which is really exciting to me. The other thing that I think, yeah, we could talk about, since you guys were talking about how this film doesn't land for you, as I feel like, yeah, this movie is about 2 hours long, and you can probably cut some corners here and there, and that kind of opens the door for us to talk about the different cuts of the film, which when this movie came out, it was already, you know, the world was already pretty much in love with these guys, and it got a pretty wide release. And with that, they ended up kind of cutting it up and rearranging things and kind of putting a little shine on it so people could see it in the West. And you get a cut of the film for the international release that's like, I don't know, it's like shaves a half an hour's worth of the film.
Yeah, yeah, I think it's almost that much, yeah.
Yeah, and it's an interesting delivery too, because the dub of it isn't just a blanket, we're going to redub everything. Actually, they leave a lot of the original dialogue in, and they kind of use the dub as like, I'd say, almost a bandage to kind of clean up delivery.
Oh, dude, that's so well put.
Yeah, it's something I've never really encountered before. It's
rescored. Yeah, I don't know if it's been done like before or since, because I mean, yeah, like the bandage, that's a perfect way of looking at it, because we'll have instances where there's a Thai actor speaking English and we use it, keeper dialogue. And then if the camera's off of their face, we ADR with somebody else. kind of so it's there are some of the kind of I don't know trends and customs we're maybe used to with some like Western dubs, but yet there is some sense of like preservation around the movie. Yeah, it's super super unique, and I don't think you can easily kind of like write off the American version because there does seem to be some care. And I also, like you were saying, Carlos, seems like the goal is to really make this kind of like a shining jewel, like for Western audiences. Like they're trying to showcase these guys.
The other thing that I'd say is that if you get a home release of it, I mean, at least in my history with it, I always would get both versions. So it wasn't like you're just getting delivered the one that they want you to see. And I would say that the localized version also isn't like erasing the like cultural side of things either. It's not like they're I think we talked about with Ong Bak how they're kind of taking the kind of cultural stuff that they feel like the Western audience wouldn't understand. All that's still in there and all that's important. They do use subtitles to kind of change some plot points.
Right.
And there's a bit of a controversial thing that they do with the main villain that we can talk about as we through. But
see, I didn't have time to watch The Protector as well, but I imagine it doesn't handle the transgender villain very well.
Well, I actually, so, I mean, we should, let's just talk about this. And I don't think it's that bad. So, well, the idea in the original version is that the main villain is a Chinese trans, and they the struggle of that character is actually really focused on trying to prove themselves in a world that kind of is against that. And I think that that's a really integral driving force for this character. And in I mean 2024, when you see that, it's in a very different perspective than when you would see it in, you know, the early 2000s. And what they do in the localized version, though, is they erase that. They
don't bring up
the trans part of the character at all.
Audience just would have
act like it's a cis woman or something like that. Okay.
A woman, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Totally.
And the actor playing this character is trans also.
Yeah, yeah, she's a trans woman, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, so, I mean, unfortunately, that's a bad choice, I feel. But otherwise, I feel the localized version is really kind of, in a way, like trying to serve the viewer. And I think at an hour and a half, you're getting a much stronger cut of a film. And the other thing that I began to mention, but I didn't, but it's rescored too. So actually the RZA is the one that handles the score for this. And honestly, it's pretty comparable to the original score. I think that there's, you know, a little more Western flavor dropped in tasteful parts. It's not like I think of some of the Jackie films that just like, oh, we're just going to throw a rap song in for the hell of it.
Right.
And they don't really
have
do
like
that.
A techno beat across the whole fight or something.
I think that the RZA's approach is really serving the film and scoring it like as a film. It's not like, you know, you're not going to be like, oh, I'm, you know, this is, you know, my turn to put my personality into the film. He's really trying to make it an actual like score. So I think that works too.
Well, before we get into the movie itself, I want to talk about the thing I did research for this film, which is I actually had some Tom Yum Gung.
like
the soup. there's a really good Thai restaurant pretty close by. It's kind of an Asian fusion because they have Thai stuff, but they also have really good sushi. A little bit of both. But I had
scorpions. Did they have or elephant?
Yeah, some pangolins.
maybe in the back. But no, actually, my a friend of ours, I think it's her stepdad, owns it. So I don't want to badmouth.
Oh, dude. Uh-oh. No, and yeah, sorry. Though it's a little bit of a spoiler. That, like what we're referring to is that ends up being kind of a plot point to this film is that there's like a black market.
The Tom Yum Gun is actually
like an evil restaurant that sells.
It's like a it's like a Captain Planet restaurant.
Yeah,
nice.
But I don't think I've ever been to a Thai restaurant in my life that was even even had a hint of evil. It's like those are basically my favorite restaurants in every city.
Yeah, for real. That was this is just me talking about my personal life. A few years ago we visited California. We went to a really small city in Northern California called Crescent City, and we had the best Thai food I've ever had in my life up there. Which is just funny because you'd think it would have been in like, you know, San Francisco where there's a huge Asian immigrant population, but nope, Crescent City. Anyways, Tom Yum Gung's very good. It was sweet and sour in a really really good way, and I was a big fan.
And actually the title Tom Yum Gung we can talk about a little bit too, because there's a restaurant in the film named after that dish, and that's focal point. But I've also heard all the creators say that this title represents a mix of different things, and what you see in this movie is a mix of martial arts, so you're gonna see a lot of different martial arts represented, and you're getting a lot of different cultures represented too. This is a very international film, and I think that the title is really effective if you're thinking about it.
Dude, yeah, perfect.
Well, let's talk about the movie itself then. But first, let's take a look at the back of the DVD. Young Kam accompanies his father and their elephants to help celebrate Songkran, the Thai New Year. But when poachers make their move, Kam flees to Australia to get back his mammoth-sized family members. Fate brings him to Mark, a wily cop with good intentions, as they fight their way through the grimy underbelly of Sydney to face off against Madame Rose and her mixture of martial artists. Cultures, countries, and creatures all mixed together in this spicy soup, stirred up by Pracha Pinkeo, Panariti Krai, and Tony Jaa once again. This is The Protector, Tom Yum Gung.
Oh, yeah, my DVD is a Blockbuster exclusive.
Awesome. Nice.
Yeah, I got the discs are blue. The case has a ribbon on top saying, like, only rent this at Blockbuster. Yeah.
I love that, where you have a big old thing. It's like, do not sell, not for resale.
Yeah, it's pretty funny.
That's fun. This movie starts with another kind of, like, more innocent rural area, kind of like Ong Bak, where you find out that this young boy who grows into Tony Jaa Kam is kind of part of a line of like elephant warriors in Thailand, and so they have like this village has a close connection with elephants and lots of real elephants, which was really cool to see.
There's a couple shots with like multiple elephants in the frame that really stunning.
I love that he rides an elephant to school.
Yeah, isn't that awesome?
Like kids are like driving in their bikes and stuff, and just an elephant walks up. that's like near the end of the movie, but there's that one point where one of the bad guys sees an elephant, the character Mark sees an elephant and has the actual appropriate response of, holy shit, is that an elephant?
Yeah, that's great. You can't do a stunt double elephant. If you're gonna have an elephant in there, it's gonna be pretty obvious if you're using a fake one.
Yeah, and we'll get to that in the
there is a very fake elephant. But
thank God. Yeah.
And this is 2005. Thailand's not going to have the best CG elephants, so it's really cool to get to see lots
but
of
we're
real
just
ones.
Glad that, that no real elephant was...
Yeah, I'm sure no elephants
part
were
of any fight choreography, yeah.
One thing that is pretty cool in some of the behind-the-scenes features is they focus on, like, working with the elephants, and... Pracha mentions that the relationship between the mother and the son elephant was a real, true relationship. And he said that anytime they were shooting with the son, the baby elephant, that the mother had to be present. So that's an interesting caveat when you're coordinating filming a movie. Yeah.
You won't even notice me. I'll just be right here at Video Village.
And there actually is, there's a website I found through this that's elephant.se, but it's an elephant database. So like, I guess there's, you know, only so many elephants in the world, and a lot of them have are like tagged and stuff, and a lot, especially in Thailand, so a lot of them have like names, and you can look up like where they are and where they're located, like if they're in like a research facility or they're in a zoo or, you know, out in the wild or whatever. But this, the elephant that I believe it's the baby elephant.
Yeah. I think
their,
so.
His name is Plaibua Barn, I believe. And whoa, that's how you say it. But yeah, he's still alive. I mean, elephants live a long time. There's a great picture of him with like his handlers and stuff.
He's got a Screen Actors Guild card.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whatever Thai.
He was out on the picket lines this past year.
Yeah, that's true. That's right. That's true.
And Tony mentions that when he was a child growing up, he had two elephants in his village. He even names them Flower and Leaf.
Oh, cool.
So,
amazing.
To see that, you know, that's such a personal relationship in the film, and having that history behind it is really cool. I love seeing it. And it is awesome seeing him do like a side flip off the top of an elephant.
Yeah. Yeah. Just amazing. And I think similar with Ong Bak and its kind of approach towards Buddhism and Buddhist practitioners, you really get a sense of love here. And, you know, you could imagine another world where you've got a producer just with a bunch of post-it notes on their wall. It's like looking for juicy ideas or something. And I do think this is a really juicy idea for kind of inciting our story. But at the same time, it's clear with, you know, Tony's character in the film and just like the approach of the movie making here that there's just so much reverence for the elephants. And so, yeah, it's just really kind of rewarding getting into any of the behind the scenes stuff for this film. And luckily Carl shared it with us recently, but the kind of main featurette from the DVD back in the day is still safely uploaded on YouTube. So definitely recommend watching that. It's like a little over an hour, I think, if I remember.
Yeah, it's an hour long.
Yeah. Yeah. Really great. Great footage and you know, NGs and and interviews with, you know, Pracha and Tony and stuff. So
the famous 4-minute long shot, there's a really cool feature there where it shows the whole scene but also shows a second and sometimes third perspective of like everyone scrambling in the background to get things in place and stuff. It's really cool.
Yeah,
amazing.
It's awesome. So elephants are very important here, and Kam, the main character, his father has a elephant, and you see this relationship develop over the years, and he has a chance to present this elephant, the mother elephant, to the king, and it's a high honor. So this is in the middle of the Thai New Year, which is called Songkran, and actually that's as we record this weekend is the Songkran. Oh. This is the Thai Water Festival.
Cool.
So we're
happy Songkran.
Just by chance, we're recording it on the perfect weekend.
Yeah.
So you see the festivities happening, and you see the elephant being looked at. And what you notice is that earlier there's some poachers that tried to take the elephant, and they were unsuccessful. But among the people checking on them is one of these characters, and The father gets kind of a whiff of this, and he's resisting, and he gets shot right away, like hot, escalates immediately. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, Kam is out with the baby elephant, and the baby elephant gets away from him. And when everything starts to get crazy, then these poachers take that baby elephant, and also the big elephant too, which is kind of on a rampage. But seeing the festival is pretty cool. It's a water festival, and there's a tradition of throwing water at each other. And
I love that the kids have a super soaker fight with an elephant that just shoots water from its trunk. It's very cute.
That's really fun.
And they're framed like so heroically, like at the super soaker.
It's like a really good pose. It's funny.
You'll see people with this kind of like paint. It's like it's called Tanaka powder. It's made from like a paste that's made from ground bark. That's kind of like a fun like signature. There's some like amusement rides, and a couple of those rides you can see they're kind of like bootleg super robots that I recognize, which is fun. But
oh, so cool.
The international, well, the Western cut of the movie does weird things with the subtitles, where they'll change the subtitles to fit the story they want to tell. And one of the things that's a major difference in the Western version is that when his father gets shot, he's killed.
Oh.
And the revenge of his death is a driving force for Calm. That is not the case in the original version of the movie.
That's really funny. Yeah, because we see him in this next scene. But yeah, that the it turns out it's like a setup to capture this elephant, and we start a chase scene involving elephants, which is cool.
Mm-hmm.
But they end up eventually they are able to capture our beloved elephants.
Mm-hmm.
But I love they like get the baby elephant, and the mama elephant is coming after it, and like, you know, going through the crowd and stuff. It's so cool.
Yeah, so they show the father kind of in recovery, and there's like some traditional dance happening, basically kind of in a similar way to Ong Bak, where a village is kind of mourning a loss. This scene is taken out of the Western version as well. It jumps us to the next action sequence. So you see these people having a party. They're all dressed in suits, and there's like cute girls and older men. So you kind of get a sense that these guys aren't the most on the level.
Yeah. Right. I think I said evil jazz.
Nice. No, dude, it's almost like a salsa music going on. There's kind of Latin flavor to what they're playing.
Oh, yeah. Cool.
Appreciated.
And the one guy is getting like flame cupping, which has a really cool payoff.
Oh man, so great.
Yeah, that's like it, like immediately, like we see them kind of partying for like a minute or so, and then a dude just gets thrown through a doorway, and you're like, what's going on? And oh, it's Tony Jaa, and he's here to kill everyone.
That cut of him flying in from off screen is just beautiful. Yeah. Actually,
you like can't believe your eyes. Almost.
Yeah, definitely need a GIF.
Yeah, I definitely have a GIF for that, because it kind of like the dad getting shot. It just kind of comes out of nowhere. You're like, wait, what's going on?
There's a deleted scene that you can see in extras that has Calm actually arriving at the place, and he beats up that kind of shorty poacher with the sunglasses and knocks his teeth out. But when you see this scene with it edited out, which honestly I think it's much more effective having him just fly into the scene, you see that guy's all bloodied up already and missing his teeth, and he's remarking on it, and you're like, I didn't actually see that happen.
Right. My favorite guy getting taken out of this scene is the guy with the flame cupping. He gets kicked into the wall, and we see it all shatter. Yeah. We see the blood on the wall. Like, ooh, that's clever.
But it's more that ingenuity of like something you've never seen in a film before, and kind of along the lines of like a lot of the genius moments from Ong Bak. Mm-hmm. It's this great way of fusing. Kind of like cultural touchstones with clever action ideas. And there's a lot more of that to come.
That kind of leads us into this kind of, it's a boat chase that they're using like these long, kind of like these Thai like speed boats.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a pretty elaborate sequence where I still am shocked that they like basically destroy this whole house.
Yeah, that's sitting cool.
Along the river.
Yeah, it's nuts.
Yeah, there is no CG for that. Yeah. There is CG used through this film.
Yeah, a little bit.
But the practical stuff, I think, trumps it.
Good.
And seeing that shot and seeing these crazy explosions. There's even an exploding helicopter.
One of the boats gets shot into the helicopter, which that's like a composite shot, but the explosion's real, which is cool.
Right, right.
Yeah, and there's some great footage of them blowing that helicopter up in the behind the scenes stuff.
And also in the behind the scenes, they show that the way they like plotted out where to put the camera and stuff for the scene was they used like little Hot Wheels, like they had little toy cars to figure out where to put stuff.
Cool. It's like your animatic. Mm-hmm. I also love the shot where the boats are kind of like piercing through that billboard.
The product placement.
Yeah, that's just, they get some choice little gags there.
Yeah, it's fun. There's actually, it's like this energy drink that you may see at like Asian markets. And you see that product placement like a handful of times throughout the movie. When they show that billboard, there's like a tight shot on one of the people on the billboard who's actually like a musician that was popular around this time. And there's a shot later on in the film where he actually is in a cameo and he's drinking a bottle of that energy drink.
Oh, that's perfect. Yeah. Dude, you've got that cameo. You have the absolutely real Jackie Chan cameo. I mean, this thing is...
Yeah, that happens pretty soon. And it's funny because in the Western release, they actually add like kind of like a blurry filter to that to kind of try and help sell it.
Yeah, I think you could also read it too. It's almost like dreamlike maybe with the filter.
Yeah, that's funny.
But if I'm not mistaken, I think they were... the intent was to have Jackie make the cameo, and Jackie and Tony had kind of begun some kind of relationship or correspondence at this point, and it just was not to end, not to be. But I love that didn't stop them.
It's
this is our Jackie Chan cameo scene.
That's like some Future Cops stuff. We're still going to do it. We didn't get the rights, but we're still going to do it.
Yeah. Right.
But yeah, we're zipped over to Sydney. So the information that Com got was that there's a man named Johnny that's taking the elephants to Sydney. So yeah, they don't waste a lot of time. They zip us right to Australia, and we're introduced to Mark, who was our buddy from Ong Bak.
Jokmok is the actor's name, and he's great in this. I like what you said that he was kind of like
Ng Man Tat.
That's it. Yeah,
yeah, and, yeah.
Kind of like the foil for the main action star. We're not foil, like sidekick kind of thing. He's great, totally. And he's a lot more to do in this movie too, which I was really happy to see.
What? And I do think that that's maybe the kind of biggest crime of the US version of the film is it significantly kind of pares down some choice moments for the Sergeant Mark character, and I think you lose a little bit of the kind of like two-hander quality that I think is super important to the movie, and it's also part of what you're serving up the audience in the aftermath of Ong Bak. It isn't just that like, okay, this crew is really strong, Tony Jaa is amazing, but it's that like Tony Jaa with Pechtai, it's like a just this amazing special dynamic, and I think the protector cut of the film unfortunately loses like some of that juice.
They chop out this whole next sequence of him. He's basically in like they're doing a profile on him for the news, and then they kind of get him in the middle of a standoff situation, and he diffuses that, and you meet that he has a partner that he kind of is clowning on the whole time.
And I love like at the barber when that like the wire gets cut on his earpiece.
It's wonderful. That's really good. So like after this sequence, you're introduced to what basically is a female lead. Similarly in the Western cut, her role is pretty much kind of minimized as much as possible. Her name is Pla. And you see that she's Thai in Australia, and she's kind of painted into a corner. Basically, she's either she can be a waitress or she can be a prostitute, according to these kind of the crime world that she's stuck into. And that's what kind of reminds me of Rumble in the Bronx. You've got this female lead that you get the sense like wants to do right, but is kind of stuck in this crime world, and she really can't get out of it.
Dude, I think a cushion related plot would just put the movie over the edge.
Danny.
My cushion.
Don't stop it! Don't rip my new cushion!
We're missing. Yeah, we need a Danny. We need a Cushion.
People want it.
Nice.
But yeah, this next scene, we get introduced to kind of our main villain through the movie, Madame Rose, and she's played by with the X. Is it a Xing or a Ching? I can never remember what the X means in Chinese names.
Yeah, I think it's
Jing Jin. Well, the actress's name is Jing Jin, who's a trans woman, kind of celebrity in China, which is cool.
Like she has like a ballet background, and yeah, another cool aspect of the kind of the villain set of the film is these are all, you know, Chinese characters, and so we get a lot of Mandarin in the movie as well. And so I thinking of like that Tom Yong Gong concept of like all of the fusion. And I do think it's possible some of this gets lost for international viewers or whatever, but, you know, it's not just this mix of Thailand and Australia, but it's also Thailand, Australia, China, and other international players. A lot of juicy stuff here.
But she's in this meeting with all these business people and find out that she's the child of like a big business guy in China. And essentially she wants to take over because she's the eldest, but since she's not the eldest son, or, you know, they never say that like she's a man or whatever, which I'm glad to hear, but they say that she's neither a man nor a woman. And so they don't really know what to do with her, that's an interesting way to look at it. And I like that she is the villain, but everyone, all the people being kind of shitty and transphobic to her are kind of more villains, which is kind of cool.
Yeah.
When I think there's also a little bit of a sense of like a Thai lens on the prejudice. And like we've already seen in a couple of the films in our arc compared to how like when we, I don't know, compared to kind of what we've drawn from in like our Hong Kong back catalog, I think already our tiny little sliver of Thai film shows, I think, a much more like tolerant, compassionate perspective. And that's something that I read in the movie, that it's sort of like, oh, see how these Chinese people are kind of back in their, I don't know, stuck in their ways or something. But I don't know how much that kind of reads, you know, internationally either. So interesting.
Yeah. And it's like I said, they totally take that out of the equation for the Western cut, which is unfortunate. And it kind of takes a kind of interesting angle off of this villain. Almost like, I mean, like I said, in a modern lens, it's almost a sympathetic aspect to this character.
But I will say, localizers in 2004 would have done a really bad job with it. So, so I'm almost more okay with them not tweak it, because I know if they had done it, it would have been a bad job.
And then you don't have like a history of internet comments of era.
Good God.
Sift through.
Then we get to see the airport, where we get to see not Jackie Chan, which is that's so funny. And we get some great non actors. With the taxi driver.
Yeah.
Some of these deliveries are fun. And I love that usually the people whose English is hardest to understand are the white Australian actors.
Yeah, totally. I mean, we're absolutely keeping up our great tradition of pulling in, I guess in this case, it actually is a mix of expats, because a lot less of the film was shot in Australia than they've kind of succeeded at making us believe. So I think there are instances where it's, you know, like with the Hong Kong tradition, pulling folks out of a hotel that can speak English and are from Australia. But yeah, honestly, like, I'm not sure if any of the local Australian actors come across super super solidly in the movie. Yeah, including Sergeant Mark's partner. I mean, he's okay, yeah, he's kind of a sympathetic guy. But yeah, their chief of police or whatever.
Oh boy.
Yeah, poor guy.
Yikes.
But I think he's, yeah, I've heard, I'm sure he's super, super nice.
I'll grab some of that audio for our listeners' enjoyment.
It would have been amazing, actually, if the US version would have like gone even a little bit further with the redubbing actors and, and redub these Aussie guys. But.
I'm taking you both off the case. It's being assigned to someone else. As of now, the two of you can help Inspector Vincent with security for the Secretary General's meeting with Mr. Sim.
Aren't you being slightly...
I'm not arguing with you. I paired you up with Mark, hoping that you'd be able to keep him in line. I didn't expect you to start acting like him.
Yep.
But yeah, so the way that they kind of intertwine Mark with Calm is that Calm grabs a taxi, and this man that we talked about, the taxi driver, kind of an unsavory type, and once he sees the cops, he gets suspicious and decides to make it a police chase. And Calm is stuck in this car, and it turns into a standoff. And we get another kind of a reveal here where there's another cop that shows up that just takes out this taxi driver. And you're starting to understand that this guy might not be on the level. And the other thing that I think is an interesting aspect of Mark's character is that as an Asian in Australia, he kind of has like a sympathy to Asians. And that hostage kind of standoff situation at the grocery store, he has some sympathy towards the guy. It sounds like they have a history, and he lets him off,
right.
Which in the end pays. Ends up being a bad decision, but here you see again that he's being kind of sympathetic towards Calm and realizing he's Thai. But as he's got him in the back of the car, they go to Tom Yong Gong, the restaurant, and Calm sees Johnny, the focus of his quest here in Australia. And he breaks out and makes chase to Johnny. And
also, Calm, by this point of the film, is wearing this very like signature red scarf, and that's going to be how he's sort of like identified by a lot of characters in the film.
Yeah, I love it. It's cool. It's
it's super. It feels, I don't know, like some kind of classic, almost like fairy tale or something. It's
yeah, great. And also like kind of a little flair of him being from the countryside in a way. You know,
I love that.
Even though he has a pretty normal outfit, it ends up being an iconic look for him in the film. Just having that scarf.
Well, and also like, I feel like we've kind of brushed against this, but maybe not like focused on it head on. But if you think of, you know, something that distinguishes Bruce Lee in his films or Jackie in his films, there's some touch of wardrobe, costume, or whatever that hopefully immediately places you in this movie and not that movie. Mm. You know, and I think really kind of, yeah, Tony's scarf and in that earlier sequence where he has like that kind of Hawaiian shirt or whatever, it's you know right away just watching a clip. It's like, okay, this isn't Ong Bak. This is the Protector.
Yeah, for
and
sure.
And he's
sure.
And his outfit is like lighter, and all the villains are wearing black, so it gives a good like visual contrast.
Yeah, I love that. Too.
Mm.
Great point.
The villain Johnny, played by a man named Johnny Nguyen. He's kind of a familiar face if you know stunt stuff. And actually, I learned while I was doing some digging for this that he was doing stunt work in Spider-Man 2.
Oh, Spider-Man, cool. Right? Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
But yeah, he runs into him and also runs into our Pla that we saw earlier, who kind of warns Calm not to get involved. But of course he's going to get involved.
Can't stop him. Johnny's kicks are very stylish though, and he gets this kind of like almost like a tokusatsu pose after a strong kick against.
And good commanding presence. Mm-hmm. And then one of our first like essential trailer shots coming up in a little bit. Which is the street light. I have no idea how this kick was achieved. I mean, it's like
just
maybe
does it.
There's a little bit of like wide angle, like kind of like looking up at it, but still, yeah. So Calm, Tony Jaa's character, like from the ground, like picture a street light that's what, I don't know,
it's got to be like
feet high,
yeah,
maybe,
8 to 10 feet off the ground. Yep. And he gets
and
like
has this bulb, you know, like a giant like white bulb, and Tony just does this straight up flipping kick, smashing the bulb all in one take, camera's not moving at all.
Yeah, it looks amazing.
It's and lands without dying.
The thing that's fun about that too is, I don't know if I mentioned this in our Ong Bak episode, but when one of the things that he would do is during promotion for films, they would do like live demos for a lot of movies. And he would recreate this high kick at some of the like live performances. So again, we're the emphasis is on how real everything is, even though, like I said, we're using some CG for stuff, and it's not to the degree that we were seeing wires in Chocolate. You're definitely seeing Tony do all his work, and you're also seeing him do everything as real as it can be. So, really exciting. And that shot is basically like the elevator pitch for Tony Jaa. Like, you don't need to see anything else. You see him land this kick in front of this guy
perfectly.
And yeah, you see the dumbfounded look on the goon that he does it in front of. It's perfect.
The goon then leads him to this kind of, again, we do have a little bit of vague drug trade in this, where he leads him to like this drug deal that Johnny's doing. And of course, Tony immediately does some sick flying knees, and the white guy drug dealer trying to deal with says in the absolute flattest voice imaginable,
"Shit. You think this is a game?
How you doing?"
Oh my God.
And then the X Games villains fly in to start fighting Tony.
Johnny pulls some kind of lever or something that's like a whistle that only rollerbladers can hear or something.
Yeah, it's like a dog whistle for X Games competitors.
Yeah. We have BMX, and I think there's like one skateboard guy and a lot of roller skating guys all coming in.
Right. But it does give us an excuse to see how like Pracha shoots that stuff. And like, it's blink and you miss it. But honestly, some of my favorite shots of the film are, you know, like X Games assemble, and you're seeing like these rollerbladers like jump on the side of a wall. And again, all this really cool kind of like low angle with wide angle lens stuff. It all just looks amazing. And then
they all grab fluorescent bulbs start fighting.
Oh, such a cool sequence. And yeah, just the sheer amount of like motion in every frame is just kind of staggering, because you've got these like wheels up, wheels down, like everyone's flipping in like this direction and that, but it's all very readable. And then it quickly breaks into what I think is kind of an unsung little section.
Yeah.
Which is the first kind of like Steadicam oneer of the movie, which is happening in this like abandoned like train cars. Yeah, I'd love for this sequence to get a little bit more love, maybe on the internet, because it's, again, almost the same amount of kind of like coordination as we're getting in and out of the cars, and eventually like, you know, kicking a bad guy through the glass window in the front. Yeah. It just looks great.
Yeah, really the cameraman should get almost as much credit as the performers in front of the camera, because when you're noticing the camera move around, it's athletic. There's this sequence where Tony Jaa is like sliding underneath fences and through these, which is basically like an industrial playground, and the camera work is just like wild. It almost seems, I mean, obviously they'd have to choreograph it in a way, but it feels the camera eye is just as important for the choreography as the martial arts is, which, I mean, us talking about action cinema for so long, it feels weird to say that like as a shocking thing, but really like I'm so glad that you mentioned how the film is shot, because it's something that I honestly was taking for granted just because of the spectacle of it. And yeah, paying attention to the camera movement itself is just about as rewarding as the action.
Oh dude, no, yeah, really well said. I mean, I think, you know, it's like we have touched on these things in like a lot of the great Hong Kong films and talked about, it's like a great shot isn't only the power of the kick and the pose and posture of the kick, but it's the fact that camera is here and not like 20 degrees off of that that spot. And but I do think a lot of these sequences in The Protector, like, this is the high watermark. I mean, and they're clearly standing on the shoulders of, like, great action cinema that came before. I mean, cinematography is at such a high level. The production design is so great. Like what you were saying earlier, Matthew, about just the contrast of Tony's costume against the bad guys. And there's great use of, you know, super moody, low lighting, but then we've got some great spill through window. So just every location looks so great. And the camera's in the right place as far as the location is concerned. And as far as, like, the position of every move is concerned, and yeah, it's just, and the performance of the camera, kind of like what you're saying, Carl. So yeah, I don't know, we're just lucky to have this movie for real.
Yeah, it is funny to talk so highly about a scene where he's, like, kicking BMX bike guys and rollerblade fools. Like, it makes this
feel in a lot of ways kind of like a spiritual successor to, like, Rumble in the Bronx or some of the 90s Jackie Chan stuff.
Yeah.
Because it is, like, it that almost feels very 90s.
It's like the 90s over.
90s are, the dream of the 90s is alive in Tom Yong Gung.
It's alive in Portland. Yeah.
It's, it all the action, like the flips and the, you know, grabbing onto pipes and swinging onto guys. All of it feels just so kinetic, and it's shot so well. Everything's so clear, what's going on. And doing this whole podcast has kind of ruined me watching any action in, like, any other movie.
Thank you.
Because every time I watch movies, I just am always like, I'll bet that looks cool, but I don't know what's going on.
Yeah. Dude,
yeah, man. Dune 2, I went to see Dune 2, and, like, some of the action I'm seeing, and I'm like, this movie looked beautiful until we started to show this action.
And I think Denis is kind of a cut above of some of the other Western directors when it comes to action, but I totally agree with you. And yeah, you'll have this kind of weird experience where it's like, oh man, dude, you've got so much command over the frame, like, your entire movie.
Yeah.
What's going on?
It's,
like,
crazy.
Once people start fighting, like,
it is. I'm so glad, Matthew, you mentioned that, because it's like we're cursed, you know. And it's like, I hate it because I feel like elitist when I start to talk about it, but it's such a rampant sin of cinema that the action is like, oh, insert action here.
Yeah,
that's basically how you feel sometimes, and that's not always the case, but definitely in, like, big action films, like, you know, the Marvel movies, and you know, so there are moments when they get the right people to do the right things, and it's a beautiful thing. But more often than not, when you get a big budget film, you're seeing action, and it's just like, you lose all sense of continuity. You lose, like, it's artificial energy that you're seeing using shaking cameras and all of this stuff. If you're a fan of this podcast, you probably already understand all this stuff. But it truly is a curse that in 2024, when you're seeing an action film, I'm just assuming it's going to look bad.
So I haven't seen it yet, and I've heard good things about it. I do want to see
Monkey
it.
Man?
People have been talking about Monkey Man. Yeah, have you seen it, Marty?
Yeah, yeah, we got to see it last week.
So I've heard a lot of people make comparisons of it to John Wick, and part of me wonders, is it actually like John Wick, or is it just well-shot action, and that's the only other movie people know of that has well-shot action?
I walked away from it with some John Wick parallels, too, where, like, to me, it seemed like it owes a little more to John Wick than I think I was even expecting, maybe. But I also think that's a totally, totally good point that, you know, it's what's in the recent, what's in recent memory for a lot of folks. And I guess, like, I'm not necessarily the greatest fan of the John Wick films.
But
I should give them credit for it. It's like, they are a counterpoint to the thing we're talking about, right? Which is, like, the American action movie where it's like, just push the camera in close and shake things up.
Yeah.
Well said. I would echo similarly those thoughts. Like, I'm happy that John Wick as a film series has gotten people excited about action films.
I love the Carlos diplomatic voice. It happens every now and then on the podcast.
That's so good. Yeah.
So, like, I love action, right? And I want it to look good. Right, and honestly, like, when it looks good, everybody is rewarded for it. It's not like, you know, this burden. And you've got plenty of people that have grown up with these things that we love that want things to look this way, but it's a multiple of things that can prevent that from happening in a film, which unfortunately, you know, I just wish action was more of a priority and you know, and something they can dedicate to in a big budget film. But it really sometimes ends up being something where they just don't want to take the time to make it look as good as it could or spend the money to get the right people to do it.
Yeah, I think it's sometimes there's that, and then sometimes it's not that like more money will like solve the problem. It really is like a philosophical thing, or even just like an approach to kind of staging the camera. So it's super interesting, but it's and I know we should like
move on.
But it's like such a such a rich topic. But I mean, I think it's like, if you're looking at like Hollywood cinema, like, and going back to like, you know, older Westerns or like some of the old serials, action is almost always about character and like reversals of power of a character. And so it's like, I mean, I remember even as a kid, like my dad would always like comment, even just like watching old Westerns, he's like, they never block a punch ever. It's sort of like, I punch your face, and then now it's like this angle and you punch my face. And so I think that even though we're like, you know, many generations removed from like that era of filmmaking, it does still seem to maybe be in the DNA of like Hollywood movies that like fights represent some kind of like character reversal, and they're kind of almost like a fever dream, you know, whereas I think definitely in Hong Kong and in other traditions, it's like, no, this like fighting represents more of the showpiece, like this is like the set piece, like a dance sequence in Singing in the Rain or something. And you can totally imagine it like all working in Hollywood films, and we have some examples like we've talked about where East meets West and it's beautiful, you know. But I think it has been kind of funny as the, you know, early 2000s are like well behind us now, to see that like, oh, that cross-pollination didn't like really take up.
It really did. It
didn't really have the effect you thought it would.
Exactly.
I mean, there's some great kind of counterexamples. I mean, like Scott Pilgrim looks amazing in those fights, and you feel like what Bill Pope learned on the Matrix movies is like, is, you know, working there.
And yeah, I mean, Brad Allen, you know, being a part of Jackie's stunt team and the kind of the eye behind it all, them working together to make those fights in Scott Pilgrim look very Hong Kong style. And I like also what you said, or we were hoping that the popularity of things like Tom Yong Gung would really influence, you know, the West to make stuff more like this. And I think even still, you know, with Everything Everywhere All at Once, the fighting in that looking the way that it does. And you know, again, Brad Allen working on Shang-Chi and Andy Chang working in the West with a big budget action. Maybe we are going to see it, but you're hoping that this would really kind of inspire more people in the West to start looking at action in that same way. And yeah, it's weird, because definitely it's a subjective thing, but honestly, when you see action delivered in a way, it's almost not subjective, because it's objectively, it looks better. You understand what's happening, and you've got professionals that can execute at a high level, and it just makes the stuff outside of the action look better, because the action itself is part of the character of the film. So
totally. I think there is a place for like it. It's critiquing something as elitist, like to go to what you were saying earlier, Carlos. But there is also a sort of like, oh no, this is like a low quality ingredient that you shouldn't feed your kid.
Yeah.
Kind of a thing. And so
it's like a high quality, it's like you're taking a high quality ingredient and then pouring milk all over it or something. Like, it's like the thing's there.
Yeah,
you actually
exactly.
just need to take stuff away. It actually will cost less if you if to make this look better.
That for sure. And yeah, I think it's sort of less like, oh, this should be like Michelin. And I think it's more like, no, this should be like a really good McDonald's meal that like holds together and is punchy.
Yeah, I got you. But
right, back to the this movie.
The only thing I want to talk about this the rest of this scene is the final stunt.
Yes,
where Tony Jaa does
iconic.
a run up and a backflip off of a glass wall, and then the ATV mm-hmm. crashes through the wall after he does the flip. It looks insane.
Yeah, it's a genius
idea. Scratches your
too.
Brain in like the greatest way. Yeah.
You get the understanding that these guys have been doing stunt work and trying to push these ideas so far that they're taking a step back and looking outside the box and understanding, oh, yeah, that's a wall, but it's a see-through wall, so we could make an amazing stunt out of this. And it just, it's super iconic. And yeah, it's definitely one of the stunts I would show to anybody mm-hmm. to prove how good these guys are.
Yeah, hands down.
All right, let's move past some of this nonsense.
So fast-forwarding a little bit, it's a lot of like the politicking, a lot of like the finding out that the police people are a little corrupt. And
Mark gets assigned to work with this Vincent, who is like the kind of bad cop, and he has to play a protector to this secretary general of the police. And Pla is kind of wrapped in this too, and there's this sexy mud bath sequence that turns into an assassination. And actually, so I was saying how the Western cut removes that standoff earlier in the movie, and you see that young man that Mark let off, he's kind of forced into committing this murder, and then he is quickly murdered by Vincent. And Vincent also takes out Mark's partner and is framing Mark for this murder. So things are getting kind of nasty. Yeah. Before that, I should say that Pla ends up basically giving a safe haven to Kam, and he has this CG dream of these the warriors, the Thai warriors that protected the king's elephant. And the idea of these warriors kind of is a driving force for his like righteous quest. The one thing that I realized when I was doing homework for this was that there was actually a Tom Yong Gung video game that was developed for PC.
Oh, wow.
And I shared you a playthrough. There's a video. It's a 3D beat 'em up. And actually, remember we were talking about in Chocolate, that video game we couldn't figure out?
Is that what this is?
That's what it is.
Oh, cool.
Oh, dude, so it's amazing. Got
the same UI. Yeah.
Yeah, and, it is. Totally. Yeah.
All of that is there. So, I connected.
Looks all janky and rough, too.
It looks like a, pretty crude 3D beat 'em up, kind of just mashing buttons. But
oh, cool. I'm just jumping around. There's a, you can crash the boat into the helicopter.
Yeah, they kind of, there's some nice artwork for cutscenes, mm-hmm. but then you're basically, moving beat for beat through the movie. Yeah. But
I think the animated sequence like is dated as maybe the models are mm-hmm. and like some of the CG. It's again very high on style and like moody lighting and stuff. And so I think all in all, I think it holds up fairly well.
It's definitely of a time, but I mean it's kind of like I guess in a similar way to Chocolate, you know.
I was gonna say the one in Chocolate I think is a little more stylish. I think it looks a little
successful
better, but I don't know this at all, but I'm sure it's the same people that animated both, so
right.
So moving us along, I do want to mention the whenever the police chief like goes in to the mud bath before he gets shot, he rides in on a Segway.
Oh man.
and then Mark makes his getaway on a Segway.
Something that looks edgy at the time, or cutting edge at the time.
Yeah, very cutting edge at the time.
It's so dated now. Yeah.
And also, I like that at one point, right after this, Cam is in the street, and there's just a really brief scene where a person's like criticizing her boyfriend for getting a pirated DVD.
A not a random person. That's actually Moy Lek from Ong Bak that's doing that line.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, that's another cameo here. And yeah, I love that too, because definitely the first time I watched this was on a bootleg DVD.
Yeah, and it's weird. It's weird in that cut whenever she just stares right at the camera for a full minute. It's weird.
Yeah, nice. But the pushing forward the relationship between Pla and Kam leads him to find out about the secret like crime spot behind the Tom Yum Gung restaurant. And that's what leads us to this wonderful one take. And yeah, you've got about 4 minutes straight with Tony Jaa, a cameraman and stuntman, and a whole crew of people trying their best to make it look seamless. And I mentioned that Art of Action last episode, and definitely they take some time to talk about that. And he says, I think that they had to do like 7 takes of this, which is a wild coordination to think about, because not only is it just the sequence itself, but it's all the destruction involved and just the footwork for not just him but the crew behind him.
Totally. And initially it was like an international Steadicam operator that they brought onto the film.
Oh.
I think he might have shot that earlier train car sequence.
Cool.
But ultimately the shot was just too tiring, and so kind of a backup Thai camera operator is the one who ended up getting the keeper.
The
keeper take. And then also it's cool in the featurette they mentioned, I think it was take 4. I've seen some different reports. I've seen one that says the keeper take is take 5.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was maybe take 3 where I think Tony got all the way through it, but it ends on this shot where he like finally reaches the evil restaurant. And it's like, yeah, kind of underwhelming line. Like, where's my elephant?
Gentlemen, I am not leaving without my elephant. Hey!
Whee!
Where's my elephant? Where's my elephant? Where's my elephant?
Hey, they're playing the elephant song.
I love that. Reminds me of elephants.
But apparently that spool, that reel of film, ran out like just before the camera got back on his face.
Unbelievable. Nuts.
And so, I mean, you have to imagine that devastation. It's like, oh, everyone did their job perfectly, but it just needs to be, you know, 8 seconds faster or whatever. I think I read somewhere that the fourth take looked basically perfect, but then they were kind of like reviewing it, you know, in the Video Village or whatever, and it's like, do you got one more in you?
Yeah.
And so yeah, it's either 5 or 7 by some reports, but I mean, this is something where I think among like all of the kind of iconic oneers, this one really doesn't need a lot of contextualization. I don't think you would even need to point out to like a non-movie buff audience like what's going on. It's just extremely self-evident that something is so unique about this that you've never actually seen a sequence that looks and feels the way this does.
I love that you can tell that Tony's getting tired as it goes on.
Yeah, exhausted.
Like, you can tell he's so exhausted, but he's still performing at this high level. But he is, like, between these big stunts, he's, like, walking a little slower, and he's breathing so heavy.
Yeah.
And I like that they bake in these kind of breaks for him. There's, like, these moments where there's action happening behind a wall or behind, like, a barrier, and it's still continuous, but you can see that, okay, you don't have to do, you're not at 100% the whole time.
Right. But it's also asking for like everything that Tony does well. So it's like, okay, yeah, you're going to get a break from kicks here, but can you acrobatically like flip up behind the doorframe in this like 1.5 second window when the camera's not looking?
Amazing.
It's so cool. Yep. And then the 2 or 3 times where a dude is thrown off of the stairs, like into the central atrium, and like the camera's catching that. And just the amount of coordination is staggering. But seriously, just to think of the imagination going into this sequence where it's like, no, like more, yeah. more.
Mm-hmm.
And not only more, but like more variety too.
And also the character of the location itself. This very winding staircase with this open atrium that's, an action movie playground, really. There's two things I have to mention. One, have you guys played Sifu at all?
Yes, I've played Sifu.
Oh, I've watched my friend play some of it.
Yeah, it's fun. I feel like as far as like kind of action movie inspired games, that's like kind of like the big hit from last handful of years, and definitely feel like they were inspired by some of the ideas in this sequence. And using furniture in a way that kind of helps the choreography, which, I mean, if you're playing the game at a certain level, it does end up feeling like you're playing through choreography, mm-hmm. which is fun to me. But
this is a very video gamey sequence.
Yeah.
It's very beat 'em up, but that's what Sifu is 100% like a kind of logical step from beat 'em ups to what Sifu is.
Yeah. And I mean, mentioning video games also. One of my favorite YouTube videos of all time is Terry Yumgung, which is this one-take sequence, but replacing the audio with fighting game voice work.
And with Fist of the North Star music in the background.
Yeah, it's pretty much all sound clips from Capcom vs. SNK2 and having fun with those funny audio clips and putting them to this movie is the perfect Carlos thing.
Hey, you!
Love it.
It's funny. One of my friends, shout out to Squid Ludwig, host of the Unlocked Door, a Twilight Zone podcast. Whenever I told on another Discord that we were doing this, he posted the Terry Yumgung video. So
it's too good.
Awesome.
Still exists. Happy to revisit it over and over and over.
So now we get our rematch with Johnny.
And Johnny's looking fresh in this sequence. His
white
his
coat
kicks are so strong.
Snake print pants and kicking like an all-star.
Yeah.
And I do think there's this extra level of just the exhaustion that was kind of obvious with Tony's character. It just adds, I think, this extra salt in the wound and sting where it's like, okay, Johnny looks really impressive here. And we know our guy is just like so beat and tired.
Yeah.
But it's also kind of like a fighting game where certain fighting games, if your health is low, you have like access to like a super move or your damage gets buffed because he's really pushed to his limit now. And actually there's a narrative beat here where Johnny tosses that bell
for the elephant earlier.
Yeah. That like supercharges him and really pushes him towards defeating all of these
all
guys.
Of these last three big fights are in fighting game stages. Like this has a kitchen in the background with like the chefs kind of looking at what's going on. The next scene's in like water with fire everywhere. One's literally like Shang Tsung watching over the two people fighting.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, totally. That's so fun. He ends up going to like the back of this restaurant where all the poor animals are being caged up. And this also has him find Mark in another reveal. Things are even worse than you think. It's not just animals, it's people as well. So you've got some sex workers that are, and there's a news story that defines them as being from Thailand. So you've got him kind of revealing this horror,
like uncovering this human trafficking
to the world.
Yeah.
But happily he does find Korn, the baby elephant, and they're making their way out and find refuge at a Buddhist temple.
And this temple location is definitely the stuff of fighting games and the stuff of, I think that, I mean, the whole history of kind of earnest, serious final fights. We're at the penultimate mm-hmm. fight in this case, you know, from the history of Kung Fu movies are kind of steering us in this direction. And so we not only have like the significance and the mood of the temple and shot in much more of, and stage, I think, in much more of almost like a John Woo-ish way, like the way John Woo shoots a church mm-hmm. or something. Mm. But then we have these other added elements of danger, you know, fire and liquid and what. I don't know. I mean, this
thing it looks incredible. And to continue the fighting game thing, whenever we see this first fighter in this sequence, he's wearing like this black hoodie thing that at first it made me think of Jin Kazama from Tekken 7, I think, is the one where he has the hoodie.
Well, it's starting in Tekken 4 was when he started to wear that hood. I actually have an awesome Tekken 4 poster of Jin wearing the hood.
Cool. But then he takes the hoodie off and he becomes Eddie Gordo because he's like capoeira and like fighting and dancing all around while he fights.
Yeah, it's such a beautiful form.
Well, as you said before, they definitely play and enjoy Tekken, so there's no way it's just a coincidence.
Yeah, and this performer, Latif Crowder, he'd go on to be Eddie Gordo in that Tekken, the bad Tekken live-action movie, but still, it's still
good casting,
cool.
Bad movie.
Yeah, I think that having capoeira put to this kind of hybrid Muay Thai tricking style of Tony Jaa is just beautiful. Actually, they fit together like puzzle pieces in certain shots. It's really great.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, that fight's incredible. I'm gonna make so many GIFs for this movie. It's gonna be ridiculous.
There's a lot of like really kind of iconic looking slow mo shots. Mm-hmm.
Oh, totally.
Yeah. And I love. I mean, not to restate things, but the setting here. It's not just that it's like kind of like this cool fighting game thing, but having him sit on top of that Buddhist statue. It's like this cool character moment for someone you have no idea who they are. It's like this sacrilege in a way, and you only see this guy in this sequence, and you have no idea of where he's coming from, just that he's probably part of the bad guys. And as he's defeated, you're still like, dang, who was that guy? It's cool. But yeah, following that, you've got this wushu practitioner played by John Fu, his name is. Mm-hmm. And he played Jin in the Tekken live action.
Yeah, I know. I was taking my notes, I was like, oh, huh.
Yeah. The other thing that I should mention about Latif Crowder is that he still works in stunts. And actually, he's a stunt double for Mandalorian.
I saw that.
It's pretty cool.
That's really cool.
Amazing.
Yeah, so the wushu practitioner, Zhang Fu, he's mainly using a sword, mm-hmm. and there's some really kind of fun ideas where using the bells in the setting mm-hmm. and kind of the big traditional drum in this temple.
And then he totally gets the mallets, and he's like using the two mallets, like the double sword technique and stuff.
Yeah, and I mean, again, as this wushu practitioner, his form is just beautiful. His kicks are solid. His leaping strikes with the Chinese sword just look super stylish and perfect in a way. So it's really cool to see this mixture, you know, this Tom Yum Gung of martial arts. Mm-hmm. And after he's defeated, we also see somebody we haven't seen in quite a while. I think the last time we saw him on the podcast was Jackie Chan's First Strike, which I think chronologically is his first role on film, but Nathan Jones, the gigantic man who, from Australia,
who you will definitely know from Mad Max Fury Road. He's the giant bald dude that has like a huge gun and stuff in that movie. Whenever I saw him in this, I was immediately like, oh, it wasn't even like a question. I was like, oh, he's the big dude from Mad Max Fury Road.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Which I guess is only like 10 years after this. So, he's just fucking huge. And Tony Jaa is kind of a smaller guy too. So he just towers over him.
Yeah, it's not just the size comparison, but the fact that this bit here is basically Tony just getting tossed and kicked.
Yeah.
Seeing the power behind those hits and the way that he flies through the air is just wild.
And that's that kind of finally brings Tony down.
Yeah. So that can move us to really what sets up the finale of the film. So you've got Madame Rose making this presentation to the news, basically revealing that they're gonna be like the new crime lord, or you know, not literally, but basically.
Yeah, and that's a scene that we jumped over, is this dinner that she's having where they're basically talking about how she can't take over the family business because of the other heirs, and she poisons the food of her siblings so that she'll be the only heir. Yeah, it's cold, and she has a kick-ass outfit in it too, so.
It's pretty awesome seeing those kids get killed.
Yeah,
what's up? That's so crazy.
Yeah, they're like kid, there's... or you know.
Yeah.
Oh,
there are... Don't pull this clip out of context. Yeah. Anyone, please.
Yeah, exactly. There's a couple of moments in this movie, and we're getting to the next one where it's like, I can't believe they did that.
Yeah,
and I can't believe like how satisfying it is.
Yeah right. But yeah, so Calm and Corn, he brings the elephant.
Yeah, he's reunited with Elephant.
Yeah, he brings, they're walking their way through Sydney to make it to this building. And there's a funny blue screen kind of composite of them walking.
Yeah, it's not great. No. But it is cool whenever they're going inside and he just walks in with an elephant.
Yep. And he challenges and it turns into this action sequence, and Mark is also there, and there's a shootout, and Vincent, the bad cop, is in the middle of it and actually ends up getting killed by Johnny, who's kind of looking a little desperate. And it's getting crazy, guys. Our final stage, your Shang Tsung comparison. I love
that. Yeah, that's perfect.
She's 100% Shang Tsung sitting on this throne watching the two guys fight.
So good.
And the big reveal is that she's not only killed the mother elephant, but is like dressed up the skeleton and has it standing behind her. And it ruins Calm. He is devastated.
And gotta say, like, some strong acting on Tony's part here. And who knows, it's like, is he channeling the elephants he's loved his whole life, like we know, but and I don't know, really a gut punch in the film, and not something that we're used to seeing. I mean, we encounter plenty of, you know, final reel of the movie deaths or whatever, but I don't know, there's something particularly devastating about this. It's like motivated like our whole story, and to kind of feel that our hero has kind of lost in this way just really takes something out of you.
He's like having like flashbacks to the like his you know, growing up with this elephant and everything, but then he gets stabbed, and that brings him back, and that is like, you know, he's going into overdrive or whatever. And now it's like 3 minutes of him breaking people's limbs. He breaks so many arms and legs. It's insane.
I love that.
There's like by the end of the scene, there's like 30 guys on the ground all writhing around.
Yeah, I imagine them shooting this, and you know, there's some NGs, so you see that some sequences had to be reshot. So I just like the idea of all the stuntmen having to continuously writhe on the ground during all of it.
Yeah,
it's pretty funny. In the middle of all of this, though, I did notice that Ron Smorenberg, he's a kicker, and he's actually one of the final guys that Jackie fights in Who Am I, that fancy kicker at the end of that movie. He's in a bit of this sequence too. He has a little short moment, but yeah, literally think like Dynasty Warriors or something, just the count of like defeats. It's like probably like 40 plus guys that he gets through here. Has like some funny, just like, I can basically do anything I want right now. It's like, how did he break this guy as an arm? Oh, he wrapped it between his legs and then did a little twist with his waist. It's like, whoa, these guys can't do anything.
And you gotta think, it's like, there is something about, like, I don't know, just like how tragic the fate of his elephant is, that somehow can like buys you enough with the audience where I have to imagine like bone breaking is probably one of the things that moviegoers around the world are like most like squeamish about, or like not really relish watching. But it's like, dude, this guy's lost his elephant. Give him some slack.
Yeah, it turns into like
it ends up kind of working where you're like, okay, yeah, it's like the only time I'm okay watching like an extended like one man bone wrecking crew is like now.
Yeah, how many ways can you break a leg? You know, you're kind of curious about it.
So after he breaks all those bones, he gets a rematch with the Nathan Jones wrestler character. My favorite stunt in this is whenever he does the flying knees, and it's like they're two of them are going at each other full strength, and they just both stop with him getting kneed in the face.
Yeah,
it's such a good shot. And showing that like, you know, Tony's got some power to him too. But and it's just so much like of like power play and whatever with Nathan Jones flurrying him around.
The idea too that it's not a situation where you're getting into the mind of Kam as a fighter, like fighting against him. So there isn't as much of a narrative to the fight, but you are seeing him approach the fight differently than when they were in the temple.
Right,
so he's using, you know, him as like almost a platform at moments where he's stepping on his leg to hit him in the head. And he's also doing kind of a low man wins where he's hitting him below his center of gravity to knock him off of balance and stuff like that. It's pretty cool. You see that there's these head blows that are causing some like visible damage to him. But I also like that the Shang Tsung in the background kind of acts like you can't do that, you know. So every once in a while, when Kam is going to get the win, you'll see this whip come out of nowhere and stop him, and that's from Madame Rose, whose martial arts basically is that she's got a whip. But you see Madame Rose do some cool acrobatic stuff too. And there's definitely a stunt person involved, but you do see some shots that this actor was actually having to do some physical stuff, which is fun.
And now
our moment.
Now, probably my favorite moment in the movie. These three more giant wrestler dudes come out.
Oh man.
And Korn comes out. The elephant comes back out too. And at first Nathan Jones tosses Tony Jaa, and then one of the wrestlers tosses the elephant.
Yikes. Me and my friends, when we were watching this, like yelled out loud, like, whoa.
I lost it. I lost it whenever I saw that.
Yeah, I still remember that. Oh. That's so funny. Wild stuff.
They Bowser tossed this elephant out of a window.
Bowser. Nice.
That's, dude, perfect.
That's great.
But this leads to kind of Tony's final form, which is he grabs some of the bones from the elephant and uses them on his arms and starts beating up these dudes with the bones.
So cool.
Yeah, it's just... yeah, brutal. And
it's a interesting idea here, and it's also like relevant to the emotions that you're seeing.
Totally.
So fun. I love it.
Yeah.
And yeah, it doesn't take much for him to defeat these guys now. Yeah. And it actually turns into this, I think it was you, Matthew, earlier on, you were talking about this Mortal Kombat idea where you're seeing these tendons for these guys get severed, and they have these like x-rays of the tendons getting...
And it's kind of Fist of the North Star a little bit too.
Oh, that's what it was.
It's like he's hitting him and the, you know, he doesn't explode after he hits him, but he might as well. But yeah, that's how he defeats it. And then the fight we finally defeat Madame Rose is she's trying to get away on this helicopter by like hopping onto like a rope that's off the side. I love she's like, she gets knocked off, and then she's finally like, looks like she's gonna get away, and the helicopter's flying away over, you know, over the ground, you know, off of a building, and Tony does a flying knee kick into her, just into the void. It's such a good shot.
Oh man. Yeah, and you've got kind of like two cameras like on the same angle. One, it's like a super long lens, and this more close up one. It's a nice final little additional splash of like a Rumble in the Bronx energy or something.
Yeah.
You know, with more like compositing, it's like less about the real stunt than like a Jackie kind of death defying thing, but a really powerful beat. And yeah, this very kind of little tiny moment and then cut away of her like crashing through back onto the kind of the gold remnants of the elephant.
Yeah, and it, actually, I'm noticing as we're talking about it that it's a different type of helicopter. So like I was thinking, oh, maybe they use the one for this sequence to be the one that blows up earlier, but this is like a much more modern helicopter. But yeah, the you can tell that there's like a blue screen happening. And I think basically it was like the body of a helicopter with like a digital like propeller added in. But yeah, it's pretty cool. And yeah, so the epilogue is pretty tight. I mean, honestly, you've got Mark kind of reporting his final epilogue. And actually in the Western version versus the original cut, he's talking in the original cut about how important elephants are to Thailand. And in the Western version, he's basically talking about Kham as a hero and how he's kind of a classic hero that I still
believe.
He has
beautiful tusks and giant ears.
Yeah,
we get the reveal after it that Madame Rose fell to her death, but the tusks of the elephant caught Kham so that he was able to survive the fall, which is very, it's goofy, but it's very, very fitting and very sweet.
Yeah, it's like the spirit of it is like looking after him.
Yep.
And that.
And then, the credits were treated to some NGs.
Yeah. Which I think they cut out of the US cut, which is it's a shame.
Yeah, it's too bad.
But yeah, that's Tom Yong Gung. I really enjoyed it. I like Ong Bak more as like a film, but this has some of my absolute favorite stunts that we've seen in a movie in a while.
Yeah, me personally, I think I prefer this film to Ong Bak, but I mean, both are great. I do feel like maybe there would be a happy medium between the original cut and the Western cut that would kind of trim the fat a little bit.
That's a great point.
But I'm happy that we get to enjoy both of them.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And honestly, I think in many ways, like these action sequences are still kind of the reigning king on the mountain for me. And not to say there haven't been some sensational action movies in the years since, but, a lot of this stuff is subjective and, to my taste, no one's really topped, what's gone on in The Protector. Since then, and including maybe even, some of Tony's work, subsequently, but
yeah, I mean, not to get into that too much, but definitely after these films, they're still trying to escalate things. One of the ideas is that Tony Jaa would move into the director's seat. So Ong Bak 2 and I believe Ong Bak 3 are directed by Tony Jaa with some assistance from
Pana, I believe.
Yeah. So and Ong Bak 2, a little bit of controversy too. I remember everybody waiting for the next film, and then I remember
there was a point of time where Tony Jaa was declared missing.
That's what I'm getting at. Yeah, yeah, fled the set, and I think that the pressure of trying to do all of that maybe was getting to him, and kind of crazy. But he would make his way into the West, and honestly, there's a good slew of films that you can find him in alongside Western actors and other Asian actors as well. He's been in Fast and the Furious. He's been in Expendables. He's a whole bunch of stuff. So I do feel like I wish that he would have starred in more stuff, and I hope that maybe that could be the case yet. But mostly he seems to be kind of an added spice to another film, which is like, it's cool. I'm happy to see it, but man, this guy is so good.
That's a good point.
He should really be in the spotlight.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed this. This has been a big blind spot for me for a while, so I'm really glad to get to check out all this, especially with you guys kind of leading the way. So
cool. Yeah, and we didn't have to dig in too deep. I think, I don't know if I mentioned the Ebert review of Ong Bak while we were recording, but there's a great bit. So if you look up Roger Ebert's review of Ong Bak, he's basically saying that he wanted to take notes during the movie, but he thought actually, he didn't need to take notes because it was such a spectacle and it was so amazing that you really just kind of have to sit and enjoy it. And I think in a way, yeah, that's the perfect way to think about these films. Really, the passion of action and the passion of kind of relating a culture and kind of the combination of a culture and like love of cinema is what they were incredibly successful with. And Pana, you know, he passed away. I think it was during either, I can't remember the year, but it was like around Ong Bak 3's production, I believe, or something like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, to have a legacy of all of these great action films that are completely distinct from anything you would see in the world is super awesome. And yeah, if,
totally.
I hope that people listening have gotten to enjoy that if they hadn't already.
Well, thank you so much for checking out our show. If you enjoyed it, then you can check us out on all the social medias like Facebook, Instagram, Threads, Twitter, you know, Blue Sky, all that stuff. We're Heroes, the number 3 podcast on all of them. If you enjoyed it, you can leave us a review on what you're listening to this on. Apple Podcasts is the big one. If you have a question for us, then you can do a question for us on Spotify, or you can shoot us an email at heroesthenumber3podcast@gmail.com. And also, if you're, this is extremely timely, but if you're listening to this the day it comes out, I'm actually doing a panel at VGMCon on Friday, which is, yeah, in 2 days from the day this episode comes out. So if you happen to be in the Twin Cities area, then I would love it if you checked us out. But all three of us will be there, or at least I hope.
Yeah,
I hope
we're all gonna be.
Let's say I hope you guys will be there at least. So yeah. But yeah, so that's gonna be super fun. It's not about, it's about video game music. It's not about Hong Kong action.
Our other passions.
Yeah, the other things. So.
Yeah, yeah, totally. And yeah, we should all be there. And yeah, please definitely, if you're at all in the area, mm-hmm, come check out Matthew's panel. And then I'm giving a panel the following day on Saturday. Yes. So
it's going to be awesome.
It's going to be fun stuff. So we're done with our tie arc and we're going to transition to our next arc. But first, we're going to have another little animated interlude. So, Carlos, what is our training for next week?
I called this shot a little while ago and I thought maybe we would sit on it. But I think, what the hell, let's do it. This is a movie that I love greatly and goes back to my anime origins. Awesome. This is 1984's Macross: Do You Remember Love? A legendary, iconic animated film that surprisingly not as easy to come across in the States, which is a complete shame. But we can get into that kind of controversial history of licensing when talk about
it. It's fascinating.
Yeah, I'm not going to try to be a comprehensive history on the mess that is Macross and Robotech.
That could literally be its own episode just about that. Yeah, so
it could almost be a podcast series, honestly.
Yeah, like a mini-series.
Yeah, we're going to just dive right into Macross, Do You Remember Love? And yep. Yeah, without saying too much about it, visually amazing. An adaption of something else, so maybe a little pushed together, but if you're just looking at it, it's nuts.
Yeah. Well, until next week, where we're taking a look at Macross: Do You Remember Love? I'm Matthew.
I'm Marty.
I'm Carlos.
And we are the Heroes 3. Remember your training.
Heroes 3 is part of the Mercado Brothers Podcast Network.